WLRN Public Radio presents Topical Currents. South Floridian Jeff Kelly recently returned from Afghanistan, where he managed the United Nations Humanitarian Air Service. The logistics of establishing a base in Kabul for aircraft, fuel, and personnel were daunting, but that's nothing new to Kelly. In the mid-60s, Kelly was a Marine reservist who decided he wanted to taste the battle in Vietnam. He arrived in Da Nang, eager to do what many of his contemporaries were busy protesting about, the waging of war against the communist Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. With a tour of intense warfare, the loss of comrades, the eroding of support from U.S. political leaders, Jeff Kelly's view of the Vietnam War evolved. When his tour ended, he had no regrets about leaving the battle which so mightily divided America. Stay tuned. Jeff T.J. Kelly next, after the news. And we're back at 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's Topical Currents. I'm Joseph Cooper. The misty images of Vietnam still haunt Americans. In square miles, both North and South Vietnam are only a little larger than the state of New Mexico, but the country still looms large in the consciousness of the boomers who served there, fought there, lost friends or family there, or endured being imprisoned. A Miami kid, Jeff Kelly, had an intense Vietnam combat tour. A proud and ardently dependable Marine, he learned to be a survivor, and by his own account was lucky to board the jet which whisked him back stateside in one piece in January 1969. Kelly was a talented radio operator who was invaluable to his unit during combat missions. It was he who could bring in air support, artillery, or medical evacuation for wounded and often dying soldiers. He published a sobering account of his Vietnam tour called DMZ Diary, which he recently republished and updated. But in the current war in Afghanistan, combat veteran Jeff Kelly is on the humanitarian side. He's on leave from managing the United Nations Humanitarian Air Service in Kabul. UNHAS is under the auspices of the UN World Food Program. Welcome, Jeff Kelly.
Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you on Topical Currents. So tell me about your role with the United Nations and the Humanitarian Air Service in Afghanistan, how it came about. We'll talk about some of your experiences there as well as your Vietnam experiences.
Well, my role over there was as the manager of the Kabul station. And the only way to get into Afghanistan is via Kabul. Everything is based in Islamabad. And we operated a F-28 Fokker jet, which is a 75-passenger jet, sort of like a small DC-9. And we operated that two or sometimes three times a day to bring humanitarian workers in, people who work for NGOs or non-governmental organizations, and diplomats, and also journalists. The journalists had to pay, but everyone else would ride free. Mm. And one of my jobs was to determine who paid and who rode free, and that led to some interesting conversations. And the journalist paid $600 for the one-way 45-minute flight. So it was pretty expensive.
And what was your impression of the country? Had you ever been there before? Or?
No, I'd never been in the Middle East before. And I was really shocked by the Middle East, by the Islamic world. It's so big. It is such a massive monolith that I don't think Americans appreciate what we're dealing with over there. And the country itself, Kabul, well, the city of Kabul, was a very interesting place. It was a very Soviet-looking. A lot of the apartment blocks were these just square blocks of apartments with no character whatsoever. And then you would find some of the old Kabul before the Soviet invasion. And that was, it looked like it had been a very nice place at one time.
Now, you went there in January of this year, and you stayed through April. What events were going on then that were most important that we can kind of get a time frame of what was going on?
Well, the interim administration of Chairman Karzai had just basically assumed power, just very shortly before then. And they were just setting up, and they were doing a lot of requesting for air transportation from me. And we were flying them around the country. We had two helicopters that were down there in Kabul, and Well, I had six helicopters all together. These were Mi-8 Russian helicopters with Russian crews that were contracted for the UN. And we would use those helicopters and also our smaller planes. We had Beechcraft, 19-passenger and an 8-passenger.
So the Russian helicopters were under the direction of the UN?
Under contract. Well, they were...
Under contract.
Under contract for us, yeah. They were. It was a company that owned them. We had the Beechcraft aircraft we flew people around in. And then we had the jet that went back and forth to Islamabad. And the interim administration ministers were always looking for free rides. And it was up to me to determine if they were legitimate or not.
And how did you do that?
I'd talk to them, and I'd also call, and they'd tell me where they're going. These ministers, and there was a lot of them, were... they were paid almost nothing. They had no money. All they had was a title and prestige. And they tried to use that prestige as currency. So they tried to buffalo me a lot. Mm-hmm. They didn't, though.
Did you get much contact with the Afghan people?
Yeah. There was a curfew there of 9 o'clock. But in the daytime, it was safe to walk around. And you could go to restaurants, and you could meet people. And I went to some of the homes of my staff members. And they're very nice people. The Afghan people really impressed me. For one thing, there was no thefts. In Africa, if you left your cell phone laying on the table, your own staff would take it. In Afghanistan, I never heard of anybody getting anything stolen.
And you mentioned Africa. You also did a similar mission in Rwanda?
Yes, that's right. That was in 99 and 2000.
And compare the two as far as the mission and what was going on.
Well, Africa was in, Rwanda was moved out of the emergency stage and they were into development. So the curfew had been lifted, the infrastructure was put in for the humanitarian effort, and there was the American club you could go to and get a good meal. There was a lot of internationals there, and there was a lot of social life. Afghanistan was just the opposite. It was in emergency. Very strict curfew, very strict security rules, and there were still bullets flying around. So there was no social life. Couldn't get a drink, couldn't get a beer anywhere, because the Taliban had destroyed all the alcohol in the country except for one container of scotch. And that's the UN club somehow got a hold of this. And you could go there and drink scotch. The choice was with or without ice. That's it.
Pretty expensive, probably.
No. It was a few dollars. It wasn't too expensive. Huh. But a cold beer would have been great.
My guest is Jeff Kelly. He had a tour of duty with the United Nations in Afghanistan earlier this year. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. Area code 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800, as usual. And also, as usual, if you'd like to join in, you can send me an email. I'm sitting here now. I forgot to open my Outlook, but it's open now. And you can zip me an email at radio@wlrn.org if you're a little shy or don't want to be hanging on the telephone. 305-995-1800. What struck you most about Afghanistan?
Islam. The effect that Islam has on that whole society is enormous. Everything is determined by Islam. The way they dress, the way they behave, the way they interact with each other, that is such a part of their life that we can't even begin to conceptualize religion playing that big a part in our lives. The name of the country is the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and Pakistan is the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. And Islam is just the most overwhelming part of that whole part of the world.
What do you think the prospects are long range there and its relationship with the rest of the world?
With the rest,
particularly the Western world?
Well, with America, it's not good, because I don't think we understand what we're dealing with. And our attempts to do things like kick food out of the back of airplanes were just seen as too little, too late. If you remember in the beginning part of the war, they were dropping peanut butter, and people had never seen peanut butter, didn't know what it was, and were feeding it to their donkeys. And we in the World Food Program felt that we should drop the food and the Air Force should drop the bombs. With Islam, though, I just think that we really have to take a good, as Americans, we have to take a real good, serious look at what we're doing. And we have to understand it much better than we do.
A look in what way?
The way it controls the minds. I think that this may have been what Karl Marx had in mind when he said that religion is the opiate of the people, because it controls everything in their way of thinking, the way of dress. They have to wear baggy clothes that don't reveal body form, and everyone does. They have to eat a certain diet. They have to behave a certain way. They treat women a certain way. It's very rough being a woman over there, even though the interim authority, if you read their paperwork, they're trying everything to get away from that. It's so finely ingrained in their culture that it's going to be a long time before the women get equal rights over there.
And what about the children? Did you have any experiences with Afghan children?
Well, there's a lot of beggars on the street, young kids, and you can't give them anything. They run up to you and they ask for a bakshish, which is dari for gift. And you know, if you give them 10,000 Afghanis, which is 33 cents, the next thing you have 50 kids around you. So I mean, just for your own security, you can't do it. And if you do it, they know your face. And what I found very interesting was I would be in different parts of the city, and people would come up to me and say, "Mr. Jeff, bakshish, Mr. Jeff." They knew my name, and how they knew my name, I don't know. Because I didn't make a practice of giving bakshish because of it was bad security. But they knew me. I still don't know why.
You mentioned earlier that part of the logistical problems that this operation incurred was to stay out of the way of the military because there were so many flights, military flights that I guess which had priority.
Right. Everything was determined by landing slots, landing and takeoff slots, which we have here. I mean, that's no big deal, but they're controlled by the coalition forces that were based out of in Doha, I think, in Saudi Arabia. And you would have to request a slot, and you had a departure time to make that slot. And if you didn't make it, you might have to wait 3 hours, and you had 75 people waiting for 3 hours until your next departure slot to take off. Because if you, the slots, in other words, you couldn't take off because there might be a B-52 raining bombs down on your flight, on the line of flight to Islamabad. So it was very tough operating in that airport. It was a visual flying rules only airport. There was no instrument landing system. There was no electronics. There was just a guy in a tower. A British soldier was up in the tower. He had a VHF radio, and that's it. No radar of any kind. Not even landing lights. Couldn't operate at night. You had the weather. The weather was very tough. Especially in the wintertime. I had one day, three flights out of five canceled. And canceling flights happened all the time. And I was the guy that canceled them. And the pilot, they were all South African pilots. And I asked them, I said, "Now, you know, what criteria do I have for canceling?" And we're on the tarmac there. And he said, "Do you see that mountain? If you cannot see that top of that mountain, I don't want to land." And that's how we did it. So everyone in the UN and the diplomats, the ambassadors, they would be unhappy for this cancellation. And I try not to let them know that I was the guy that canceled it.
Okay, let's take a short break on Topical Currents. My guest is Jeff Kelly. We're talking about Afghanistan, and we're also going to touch on his Vietnam memoirs.